we have tried, maybe because we've heard Janet Kerr Tenner at an earlier stage predict that education was going to be a matter of interest in the presidential campaign. We've tried to have some discussions on the presidency and education. Frank Keppel was here, David Clark, Sam Halperin made presentations. On October 27th, Harold Howe, who was Commissioner of Education, will be here. I hope all of you can join if possible. And we look forward to some other discussions. But Janet, in addition to her age and charm, also has the great advantage of, for us, of being a known quantity. This is her doctoral committee.
Is he still crying?
Still trying to get past
She's gonna get
a attempt.
She is an independent consultant in higher education in Washington, and has done studies and reviews for the Department of Education, for George Mason University, for the LBJ Center, and for Virginia Tech. She, by the way, is a BA from Virginia Tech in English, and was an MA from the University of Virginia in communication. So all these interests and talents come together in her work on education. And among her writings are Eisenhower and Federal Aid to Higher Education, which appeared in Presidential Studies Quarterly in the summer of 1987, From Truman to Johnson, Ad Hoc Policy Formulation in Higher Education, which appeared in the Review of Higher Education. She's currently working on a major study entitled According an Elusive Consensus, the White House and Higher Education, 1945 to 1988. As an avocation, she is married, has two sons, is active in Fairfax County Community Affairs, and also active in various higher educational professional associations. So we're very pleased that we have this opportunity to meet with her and to discuss with her a series of topics that relate to the presidency and the higher education, beginning with the presidency as the chief legislator. So we're pleasure to have you, Janet.
Thank you. I appreciate all of you being here today. It's a much larger crowd than I expected, but Helen predicted that you all are pretty loyal about turning out to these events, even if it's not Doc Howe or Don Reagan. I also appreciate seeing familiar faces, some that take me way back. I could probably say that those of you who I know from way back didn't have gray hair then, but that tells you how old I am. So, just barely in the 30s. So, but I do appreciate your being here. I think we have to look at the current campaign and ask ourselves whether politics and education make strange bedfellows. One is tempted to say yes when George Bush says that he wants to be the next education president. I have been wondering a lot lately about what LBJ would have to say about that. On a more serious note, I think that we'd have to say that judging by the last 45 years, education and presidential politics have, like an old married couple, grown rather accustomed to one another. Every president since Harry Truman has paid tribute to education, some with more sincerity than others, of course. And it's probably not much of an exaggeration to say that education as a subject for rhetorical pieties ranks right up there with jobs, motherhood, and apple pie. Maybe these days we should add military service to that list. Presidential candidates are not immune to education's rhetorical allure either. Harry Truman repeatedly invoked the education muse on his 1948 whistle-stop campaign for re-election. So did John Kennedy and his 1960 opponent, Richard Nixon. So it seems that candidate Bush's profession of faith in education is really nothing new, at least not in the larger scheme of things. I'll return to the latest candidate's views on education toward the end of the discussion, but before getting into that, I'd like to talk about the role of the president in domestic policy formulation and about the contribution of the presidency in developing federal education policy since World War II. Perhaps one of the most important developments in the presidency since the New Deal era has been the expanding legislative functions of that office. The president is no longer merely our chief executive, he is also the nation's chief legislator. And he's expected to hand down a list of legislative objectives each year following the State of the Union address. The only president who broke with this tradition was Dwight Eisenhower, but he did so only once in 1953, his first year in office. I guess he just didn't know any better. He was severely criticized for this omission by both Democrats and Republicans. The growth of this legislative role has created a huge increase in the president's need for information and advice. And as a result, the Office of the President now rivals some agencies in the size of its staff. The White House has become a sort of huge brokerage firm that sifts and selects issues for its clients' portfolio. Presidential scholar Thomas Cronin, who has probably written the most about the presidency in the last 2 decades, describes the modern presidency as an educational institution, with the main pupil being the president himself. But the anomaly in all this is that, unlike other institutions of learning in which knowledge and expertise accumulate, the presidency is essentially a discontinuous institution. Every 4 years or so, it has to be completely reorganized, new support staff brought in, new teachers, and a new pupil. Now, the downside to this de novo reorganization, as you have heard many times here at the Miller Center, is that the presidency tends to have a very short institutional memory, not unlike its current occupant. Every issue of possible interest to the president has to be relearned, and every presidential advisor has to build new ties to the relevant agency, interest groups, congressional committees, and so on. But the upside to this inefficient arrangement is that it allows for a large degree of freedom in the substance of policy choices, because with the infusion of new people come new ways of looking at things. This license to rethink old ideas and come up with new approaches, I think, distinguishes policymaking in the White House from policymaking in the federal bureaucracy and the Congress, where precedents, procedure, and the presence of interest groups tend to hamper innovation. And we think of domestic policymaking as having 5 stages, basically: agenda setting, initiation, which is usually in the form of legislative submissions, modification, adoption, and implementation. The bureaucracy dominates the implementation phase, the Congress dominates the modification and adoption phases, but the president is the preeminent force in agenda setting and initiation. There have been a number of studies in the last decade by Stephen Shull, John Kingdom, Paul Light, Thomas Cronin, Nelson Polsby, among others, which have shed some light on the president's agenda setting role and behavior. I think in some respects these studies tend to confirm systematically what most of us have already observed on an ad hoc basis. For example, we now know that presidents who actively articulate an agenda of items they perceive to be important have more success in realizing their policy objectives than those who don't. We also know that policies proposed in the first 2 years of an administration usually stand a better chance of adoption than those proposed in the last 2 years of the administration. And the reasons for this are complex, but they seem to boil down to the fact that the president's political capital is greatest early in his term. It will come as no surprise to this audience that the president's agenda reflects those policies that the president thinks have the greatest chance of adoption. Recent research enables us to break this observation down a little bit. Presidents choose their agenda items first with an eye toward the electoral benefits that they'll bestow, in other words, to increase their political capital. Next in importance to the president is whether proposed agenda items have any potential historical significance. Last in importance are the programmatic benefits a proposed policy will create. Now, I must admit that as an idealist, these priorities, and particularly the first one, strike me as pretty cynical. But when I looked at the behavior of presidents regarding education policy choices over the last 40 years, I was dismayed to find that most of their behavior supports this generalization. Probably the best example is Jimmy Carter's decision to make good on his campaign promise to the National Education Association to establish a cabinet-level Department of Education. I can honestly say that I see few immediate benefits to students, schools, or colleges in this move, and even fewer to posterity. Recent research yields two other bits of insight into presidential agenda setting. First, presidents enjoy the most success with policy proposals that can be classified as distributive. In other words, policies that don't upset the economic apple cart. With few exceptions, education proposals fall into that category. They enjoy less success with policy proposals that are redistributive, such as welfare payments, school lunch program, things of that nature. And they have the least success with regulatory proposals. Not surprisingly, the vast majority of policy proposals we find on the White House agenda are distributive. Just like the rest of us, presidents tend to play the odds. Historically, modern presidents have been generous in their lip service to the importance of education. President Nixon, in fact, issued the most public statements on education. I was surprised to find that because I'd always assumed it was Lyndon Johnson. However, education as an item on the White House agenda has usually taken a second seat to concerns with employment, welfare, the economy, agriculture, and so on. And when education has appeared as a top priority, it has often done so as a handmaiden to other pressing national interests. And this is a rather curious phenomenon, but we see it time and again in Truman's unsuccessful proposals for college student aid, which were touted as a way of shoring up manpower. Producing sophisticated manpower. We see it in Eisenhower's National Defense Education Act with its emphasis on math, science, and foreign language training. The very name of the act gives some indication that it is not purely for education's sake, that it was a pass. And I think more recently, and maybe a little more obliquely, in the Reagan administration's interest in education as the first line of defense against economic decline. I think that the case can be made that even LBJ's 1965 landmark education acts were designed at least in part to further his goals of beating poverty and encouraging the civil rights movement. Now, some might ask why presidents have adopted this handmaiden approach to federal aid to education. Why haven't they endorsed a federal role that promotes education for education's sake? After all, we all acknowledge its importance in a democracy and its importance in individual well-being. Well, I think the answer goes back to the long tradition of state and local responsibility for education. Both the White House and the Congress have been sensitive to this tradition and have tended to intervene where states and local communities demonstrably fail to meet their responsibilities. For example, in providing educational opportunities for the handicapped, for, we might add, the linguistically handicapped, and for the economically disadvantaged. But I think the reluctance of modern presidents to depart from this tradition also says something about the nature of the presidency as well. And this goes back to Thomas Cronin's observation that the president acts mainly as a broker of ideas and issues. The president and his aides are not inventors, and the White House is not a think tank. So if originality and innovation take place in the White House, it tends to take the form of selecting issues that are already in circulation somewhere and then matching those issues to solutions that are already in circulation somewhere. If I could use a rather crude analogy, it would be in the fashion industry. The president doesn't design this season's garments. Instead, presidents are like department store buyers who go out and visit the various couturiers and look things over and decide which dresses and accessories will be reproduced and offered to the public. Where then do the White House's education proposals come from? They don't invent them. Where do they come from? This question is always a bit tricky to answer because clear cause and effect is exceedingly rare in public policy formulation. As Cronin and others have pointed out, national policy usually comes out of a very long, disorderly process that has multiple actors and multiple points of entry. The exceptions to this rule are breakthroughs that come about as a result of a national event or crisis, but in education we have seen few of these. The 1957 Sputnik is often credited with the passage of the NDEA. I think it's kind of fun to think of the Soviets as being responsible for one of our major pieces of education legislation. And the passage of the 1963 Higher Education Facilities Act is often described as a post-mortem tribute to John Kennedy. But even these instances of policy development have antecedents that date back to the 1940s. Again, clear cause and effect is very rare. For the most part, post-war presidents have looked at two sources for education advice. Naturally, they look to their top policy makers in their cabinet and agencies. But they also look to ad hoc commissions and task forces. And these are temporary groups that are typically convened for a period ranging from 6 to 18 months. They work out of the basement of the old executive office building, and they are given a fairly specific charge, and they develop a report and recommendations from those. From their deliberations. But ideas also come up occasionally from the Congress, and we have a couple of examples, one being the 1978 Middle Income Student Assistance Act, which was attributed to Carter, but was in fact the favorite project of John Bradamus and some others in the Congress. And that essentially made it possible for all of your middle-class children to get federal aid to go to college. Another example would be the 1966 International Education Act, which never got funded, by the way, but is still on the books, still gets reauthorized every year, but hasn't gotten any funds yet. And sometimes ideas come from contact with education interest groups like the National Education Association or the American Council on Education. And sometimes a president's interest in education is piqued by things that are current in the news. A good example would have been both Carter and Reagan's interest in the problem of declining standardized test scores in the public schools. They both kind of picked that up out of the paying attention to what's in the media. The bulk of education proposals that land on the president's desk do come up through the legislative clearance process, that is, from the department to the budget office and then to the White House for review. But the White House and sometimes top political appointees within the administration have often looked to outside commissions and task forces. President Truman appointed a higher education commission at the recommendation of White House aide John Steelman. And Eisenhower did likewise after succumbing to pressure from his education commissioner Samuel Brownell and from his secretary of HEW, Marion Folsom. Now, LBJ's reliance on secret task forces is absolutely legendary. Nixon also appointed but ignored education advisory panels. Reagan's Commission on Excellence in Education, possibly one of the more influential public commissions we've seen in a long time, is the latest in this post-war succession of advisory groups. Why have presidents found education panels so irresistible? The general wisdom has it that the White House basically distrusts the bureaucracy, that it has a hard time getting the bureaucracy to adopt the presidential viewpoint. This appears to be true even when the White House has succeeded in placing its own disciples at the head of an agency. As one writer put it, there is always the strong suspicion that the department secretary will marry the natives. But I think the attraction goes deeper than just the desire to circumvent the bureaucracy. Task forces and commissions temporarily extend the policymaking prowess and capacity of the White House. They help to legitimize the issues that the president is interested in. But most importantly, they just provide information and fresh perspectives on issues. I should qualify the word fresh by saying that members of commissions and task forces are not neutral, purely objective individuals. They almost invariably lean heavily in the ideological direction of the president who appoints them, and that, of course, is no accident. Hence, you can get conflicting advice on the same problem, as did Truman, whose commission said, enact a program of federal student aid immediately, and then Eisenhower, whose commission said, let the private sector and the states worry about the problem. Commissions and task forces are primarily a tool of presidential policymaking, but every now and then they become vehicles, or their reports become vehicles for advancing causes that are close to the hearts of the bureaucrats. 6 months after the publication of the Commission on Higher Education's report, Truman had not responded to its recommendations. So his budget director, Frank Pace, and Oscar Ewing, who was head of the Federal Security Agency, which had control over education at that time, got pretty impatient, and they decided to pressure Truman into submitting a program modeled on the commission's report, and he in fact did. HEW Secretary Marion Folsom and his assistant, Elliot Richardson, found themselves in a similar situation with the 1957 report of the Committee on Education Beyond High School. Without waiting for the go-ahead from the White House, Folsom and Richardson formed a task force inside AGW to develop a legislative program based on the report. They told Eisenhower that their program was nearly ready for him to look at on October 2, 1957. On October 4, 1957, Sputnik was launched, and along with it, the Folsom-Richardson program. We can also find examples of task force and commission reports that just seem to wither away. And this was the case with the report of Kennedy's Task Force on Education, a very blue blood, blue ribbon group of people who were very serious in their undertaking. They developed a program for the president to submit in 1961. But the report was it accidentally leaked to the public, and it had a huge price tag. Well, by those standards, it was $9 billion. By today, that would probably be nothing. But because of that, and because of the fact that the report did not provide for aid to the parochial schools, which, as you'll recall, was a very big issue in the campaign, in Kennedy's campaign, whether he would help to underwrite the Catholic Church's school. But because of it omitted any aid to the schools, and because it was too expensive, the press just attacked it, and so did a couple of Catholic cardinals and a few others. And it turned into a big mess. Kennedy bravely tried to defend the report, but he then discovered that the better course was just to let it disappear from view. Nixon's transition task force suffered an almost identical fate. While the report did not depart from the Republican Party line in any significant way, neither did it inspire the president to spend any of his political capital on it. And what are the lessons we can draw from these vignettes? Well, history suggests several things. First, ideas proposed by commissions and task forces do seem to have an edge over ideas that emanate from other sources, mainly because these panels are well positioned to capture the president's attention. Second, major new ideas brought to the president's attention early in his term, when he is actively looking for issues to grab onto, and when his political capital is high, appear to have a better chance of adoption than those that are generated later. And a classic example of this phenomenon is, again, the Folsom-Richardson NDEA proposals, which were formulated in 1957, the second year of Eisenhower's second term. By 1959, Eisenhower was much less receptive to their machinations. He refused to give them leeway they needed to develop a college construction plan that would be acceptable to Congress. So we have an example of Eisenhower being very interested early in his term, but not so interested later in his term. Third, a task force proposal must find an ally in an advisor who is close to the president, a policymaker in the executive branch, or an advisor right in the White House. This person has to be willing to press for the inclusion of the program with the president. But sometimes, even if you have someone close to the president who endorses a program, it's not enough to get the program on the agenda, particularly if the budget is tight or if the president feels that his political capital is on the wane. We find a real interesting illustration of this in 1967 at the height of the Vietnam War and in the midst of mounting deficits. White House aide Joseph Califano sent a memo to the president based on after reading a task force report that recommended substantial grants to higher education, essentially a program to give higher education a little bit of free, unrestricted cash. In his memo, Califano told LBJ that if you support this program, your record of support for education will be unparalleled in human history, and I am quoting. In fact, LBJ supported the idea. He said, let's go with it. But Califano was unable to get the proposal past either the budget director, who at that time was Charles Schultz, or HEW Secretary John Gardner. Schultz vetoed it on fiscal grounds, and Gardner said it was just plain old bad policy. I'd like to switch gears a little and bring us into the present, and I talk a little bit about the Reagan administration in education. I think regardless of where you stand on the Reagan record, I think you have to agree that Reagan has done a remarkable job of elevating education as a subject for national debate. President Reagan and his education advisors, William Bennett and Chester Finn, have given fresh meaning to the words bully pulpit. With help from the National Commission on Excellence, which produced the bestseller report, A Nation at Risk, they have successfully reformulated the rhetoric of federal aid to education. Now, I say rhetoric for two reasons. First, because the actual federal contribution to total spending in education remains at about 9% for elementary and secondary education and 20% for higher education. And this is where it has stood for the last 15 years. Second, while Reagan's policies have dramatically altered certain features of existing programs, I think his policies have produced an even more dramatic change in how the nation talks about education. Professor David Clark of the Curry School of Education sums up the difference this way. Under Reagan, the terms of discussion have changed from equity and access to excellence, from school and social welfare concerns to economic and productivity concerns, from federal intervention to state and local initiatives. Reagan's paradigm for the federal role in education looks to the past. He has reduced the Department of Education's size, He has eliminated new departmental program initiatives, and in their place, he has emphasized information sharing and exhortation. The department now resembles the U.S. Office of Education as it existed under Dwight Eisenhower. What has Reagan actually done to make the reality conform to the rhetoric? In his first term, he obtained a 20% cutback in virtually all major education programs. He then consolidated into block grants a number of categorical aid programs, including Title I of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. Now, this move effectively eliminated the Department of Education's role in specifying what these programs should do and how they should be run. Reagan also endorsed the reforms recommended by his commission in A Nation at Risk, and he gave Secretary Bennett, wide license to interpret these reforms, which he has done most recently in his model curricula for the imaginary James Madison Elementary and James Madison High School. Last but not least, Reagan has squeezed eligibility requirements for federal student aid, particularly Pell Grants, which serve the neediest students. But as David Clark suggests, one cannot measure Reagan's impact merely by looking at numbers or percentages or changes in the Department of Education. Reagan's rock throwing in the federal education pond has created ripples that are reaching shores closer to home. State and local education officials have been galvanized by the new federal rhetoric, I think. And to change metaphors, the feds have thrown the education reform ball back into the laps of the state and local officials, and to everyone's surprise, they have run with it. Reagan's rock throwing, or ball throwing if you prefer, has also altered expectations. Organized education interests, along with the states and the public at large, have come to expect less direct federal intervention and fewer federal subsidies in education. Where does this leave us? With a permanent expectation of less, or with a vacuum waiting to be filled? Perhaps a look at the candidates' views on education will give us some clues. I think that education has become a much more visible facet of the 1988 campaign than most of us would have predicted 2 or 3 years ago. Why so? Well, for one thing, the fallout generated by A Nation at Risk has been very slow to settle. For another, Secretary Bennett has saved some of his sharpest attacks on higher education for the last part of the Reagan term. But there are also other reasons as well. The publication of two more bestsellers on education, E.D. Hirsch's book, Cultural Literacy, and Alan Bloom's book, The Closing of the American Mind, as well as numerous private and state commission reports, have kept the fire burning. I think the candidates have seen an opening for exercising some leadership on the issues. Both Bush and Dukakis have assembled teams of education advisors. I believe Bush's team has 30 people on it already. Both have been out taking readings among education interest groups and trying to find out what the issues that are that they're interested in. And both have been very quick to issue position papers on what ails education. What are the issues they have singled out for treatment? If we look at their position papers, party platforms, and their public statements, we find, I'm afraid to say, relatively little that is yet either new or specific. There are some issues that Dukakis and Bush seem to agree on. One of them is increased federal funds for college student aid, particularly loans. Last week, you may have read that Dukakis unveiled his plan for a loan program which would enable students to pay what they borrow out of their lifetime earnings. Bush has also gone on record in support of this type of a program. However, it is not a new idea. In fact, it dates to at least 1966 and to the economist Milton Friedman. But we have already seen that presidents have rarely endorsed ideas for education that can be labeled true innovations. Dukakis and Bush also agree that we need better teachers, that our teachers need better pay and more prestige. Along these lines, Dukakis has proposed a National Teachers Corps, again, an idea borrowed from the 1960s, and a program, this time borrowed from the 1950s, of scholarships to students who promise to teach after college. Bush hopes to promote merit pay for teachers through an experimental program of $1 million bonuses to the states. Dukakis takes a more systemic approach to the problem of improving the public schools. He's talked in very vague terms about creating a federal program that would somehow encourage the states to equalize financing among school districts. Bush, clearly distancing himself from the Reagan administration's no-no attitude toward categorical aid programs, has endorsed federal cash awards of $100,000 to every school that significantly lowers its dropout rates or raises its standardized test scores. In an even larger leap away from his boss, Bush is also offering $50 million to the states to create the magnet schools that the Johnson administration ran out of money for. The candidates appear to part ways on vouchers, mandatory performance testing for students and teachers, and expanded bilingual education. Bush has endorsed the first two and Dukakis the latter. Bush has promised greater federal spending on scientific research conducted in college laboratories, while Dukakis has promised only to shift money spent on defense-related research to non-military research. There are issues that the candidates have neither agreed nor disagreed on. In fact, they haven't talked about them at all yet. I think that among these issues are some of the most crucial we face. For example, what are we going to do about the increasing number of children living in poverty? How will poverty affect their learning potential, and what and how schools teach? I think this problem bears, at least tangentially, on the reform movement which is now taking place in our schools. As the education scholar Jim Guthrie has pointed out, the reform strategy assumes that our basic mode of schooling is essentially correct, and that all we need to do to improve things is to intensify that. In fact, that approach seems to help students who are in the upper and middle ranges of ability, but it does very little so far, the evidence suggests, to help students who are in the lower ranges of ability. Now, if we have vast numbers of children who are coming into our elementary schools poorly nourished, poorly prepared, are our reform efforts going to be for naught? Another issue the candidates have yet to consider is that of civic education. And by civic education, I mean education that prepares our children for their roles as citizens in a society that is increasingly heterogeneous. We are quickly approaching the time when our society will no longer be dominated by European intellectual and cultural traditions, as much as some of us don't like to hear it. It is true. Are we making a conscious effort in our schools to forge from all this diversity a common identity or outlook that will enable us to survive and prosper as a nation? I don't think forcing everyone to recite the Pledge of Allegiance is the answer. A third problem that the candidates ought to address is whether we are doing enough to prepare our children for changes in the 21st century workplace. Does our curriculum anticipate these changes? We've heard so much about the decline of manufacturing jobs, the rise in service sector jobs, the increase of automation and computerization in the workplace. A related problem stems from another change in the workplace, the increasing number of working women with preschool children who are in daycare. Well, these children, many of whom have been in institutionalized daycare since birth, have educational needs that are different from those our schools currently address. A last issue worthy of our candidates' attention. Will our schools and colleges prepare tomorrow's citizens for the changes that are now taking place in the international, political, economic, and I would add environmental arenas? For starters, we need to give more attention to foreign language training, geography, and third world history, and not just for the college bound. These issues, I will admit, are almost depressing to contemplate. Their size, their complexity, makes me wonder whether the former Secretary of Education, Terrell Bell, wasn't right on the mark when he recently called for a Marshall Plan for U.S. education. Now, I'm not suggesting that our candidates must come up with immediate solutions to these problems. I can appreciate the fact that the solutions will be controversial, and that, as a rule, politicians do their best to avoid controversy during an election year. However, I will suggest that the candidates, and certainly the next president, ought to put these strategic issues high on their discussion agendas. One last thought before I turn the floor over to you. Perhaps the reluctance of presidents and presidential candidates to think strategically about education, to be proactive rather than reactive, says something about the American public as well. As education writer Jim Guthrie recently wrote, it is difficult for presidents to lead where no one wishes to follow. If we want presidential leadership on education, maybe we should start by demanding it, just as we demand that he lead us on matters of defense and the economy. I'd be happy to entertain any of your criticisms, comments, or questions.
Paul David.
I don't want to talk too long, but this exercise this morning brought back a host of reminiscences for me, because I was heavily involved in this kind of thing during the Roosevelt administration for several years, but have been completely out of touch with it since the early years of the Truman administration. Mm-hmm. When Floyd Reeves and I were finishing our work for the Brownlow Committee in the summer and early fall of 1936, Francis Perkins, then Secretary of Labor, persuaded the President to create a committee on vocational education, which was at that time at the mercy of the American Vocational Association, one of the most effective lobbying groups that Washington has ever had, and something of a thorn in the flesh of the Labor Department, which wanted to promote apprenticeship as an alternative to vocational education in the school. So Ms. Perkins, having got that committee agreed to by the President, got Floyd Reeves to come in as chairman of it and director of this research program, and he took me along as secretary of the committee, and I eventually did the drafting on the committee report, which went to Congress, I guess, in 1938. Mm-hmm. Roosevelt, I left out a step. We were only a few months into the work of the Committee on Vocational Education when the President began to get a little upset, Roosevelt, that is, about the efforts of the National Education Association to promote a $300 million bill for federal aid to education. And Roosevelt, of course, I think in his attitude on these matters was very heavily influenced by his experience as governor of New York, where he knew how powerful the education lobby could become if they once got their foot in the door. Mm-hmm. And in effect, I guess again with Ms. Perkins' influence, he agreed to expand the scope of this committee, what was originally known as the President's Committee on Vocational Education. It was made clear to us at that time that he did not like the use of the term president in the name of the committee. He thought that was too aggrandizing or something. But anyway, the committee got reorganized as the Advisory Committee on Education under the auspices of the White House. And four very prestigious members were added, including George Frederick Zook, then the president of the American Council on Education. And we then went ahead and during the summer of 1937 had a research organization of around 80 people and produced eventually the committee report. The main emphasis in the committee's thinking was on the problem of educational disparities among the states. The problems with states like Mississippi, where schools were terribly impoverished, and for months we fiddled around with statistical formulas on how to figure out a scheme for federal aid that would help the poor states without simply enriching the rich states, all of which would be politically difficult and quite unpopular in Congress, where every member of Congress wanted something for his own state. Anyway, we did get the report in, and during the following year, we edited and published 18 monographs, I think, on various things that had gone on, including one on the NYA and so on, National Youth Administration. During that exercise, I discovered that there had been a presidential committee during the Hoover administration, which also produced a two-volume report, which, as far as I could tell, had sunk without a trace, probably because of the oncoming depression and Hoover's own reluctance to get involved in anything that cost money. But anyway, I guess what I'm wondering is whether that report of the Roosevelt Committee also sank without a trace. I helped nurse bills in Congress that were built on it, which never got anywhere. And during World War II, while I was in the Budget Bureau, I also worked for a while on post-war plans for education, yes, which involved presidential schemes, some of which I guess did get built into what the Truman people did. Yes. But by that time, I was out of it. But anyway, did the Roosevelt report really sink without a trace?
Well, I will. I'll make you feel better by saying that I began my research with the Truman administration. So, I strongly suspect that the report you're talking about was read by the Zook Commission, which was Truman's Higher Education Commission. You mentioned that George F. Zook had been involved in this project that you were working on, and he in fact was selected by Truman to be the chairman of the Higher Education Commission, and he had access to the American Council on Education had all of those archives and supplied, was the main supplier of information to the commission. So my suspicion is that that report was available to Truman's commission. What happened to it, you know, beyond that, I really can't really even speculate. But you raise an interesting issue to show you how the old French saying, the more things change, the more they remain the same. You mentioned that your commission looked at the committee, looked at the problem of how to address the inequities in school financing among the states. Well, this has been a thorn, you know, that we've tried to pull out of our sights for the last 50 or 60 years. And if you notice, when I was summarizing Dukakis's proposals for education, he is proposing that we again attempt to pull it out of our side by coming up with some kind of a scheme that will entice the states into abandoning the old form of property tax-based school financing and come up with a state scheme for financing schools. But that is a political powder keg, and I don't think we're going to see a change there for another 50 years. I just think there are residual attitudes, racism still, classism, whatever, will prevent it from happening. The places where it will happen will be the places that don't have much of a problem.
I'm sure, Mr. Ranieri, this isn't true in Virginia.
No. We're a true microcosm of that problem. Fairfax to Wise County. Mm-hmm.
Since you have the floor, do you care to ask a question?
Mm-hmm. Well, the question would be, I see you mentioned vocational education is coming back. Again, it was in the past, as Paul was mentioning. And it again is rearing its ugly head because in the states they're being asked to raise the quality of education. Mm-hmm. And there are some who feel if you raise the quality of education, will increase the drop. Good example of it. And Virginia is coming about looking at it, but some states have taken tremendous strides in that direction, which I feel is addressing a holistic approach to education, which you bring up as a Marshall Plan. I think that's the only way we can look at it, as a Marshall Plan or a holistic approach to education, and not just education without the social aspects.
I have to agree with you. Next
question.
I think one of the real reasons that Janet came today was so that she could sign the Miller Center guest book right next to Don Regan.
Oh. No, the real reason was to get away from my 4-year-old and my 8-month-old.
Well, I do have a question. Mr. Cavazos, who will take the position of Education Secretary instead of Mr. Bennett, next week, I believe, had said in his hearings before the committee on the Hill that he wanted to see the U.S. federal government take a vital role in education. And that is not the position, if I understand it, that Mr. Bennett wanted or promoted during his tenure. Would you care to comment on that? What are your views about a deeper role of the federal government?
Well, first I'm going to say that I love to really ruffle my far left liberal friends, of whom I have many. This sounds suspicious already, I agree. But by saying that I think that with the exception of the severe cuts that education programs have experienced, I think the Reagan years have been good for education in the sense that we need periodically to step back and look at what we're doing, to, you know, do an honest critique of the job we're doing in education or in anything else. And for years, the assumption has been since since the Johnson era, that more money, more programs, more federal intervention is an unassailable good. And I don't think that's true. And I think that the Reagan years have been good in the sense that we have stepped back and said, let's not take this assumption for granted, let's reexamine it. I think there is a middle ground. I think Bennett has been the leading person in articulating, probably in a little more extreme language than some people would like, the need to question operating assumptions. There may be a middle ground, and maybe this is what Mr. Cavazos is, I need to practice my pronunciation, is working toward, the idea that we've identified what works and what doesn't work, and let's capitalize on what works. I mean, we haven't yet to see what he's going to do and whether he'll really have any time or opportunity to do very much. But I would say that if I were reading his mind, that may be what he's thinking.
Next question, Professor Fernbaum.
I sort of preface by saying I look at the problem of education not in 4-year chunks, but rather as a matter that's continuously with us, and it doesn't get solved, it just keeps changing, and we have to work at it all the time, and that you get big movements when you do get crises on which presidents or others, governors or what have you, can attach a program on which they can swing the public along. I wonder whether I agree with you that we've had good use of the bully pulpit recently, but I wonder whether your test isn't in legislation at the federal level so much as what's happening in the states. Is there a study you making or other people making a study of the states' responses, which are also responses to crises for the Rust Belt states, for example, see their future in terms of new technology for which they have to have a better labor force, et cetera, et cetera, and therefore education may be the path, and so on. What kind of responses are we getting out of the states?
Well, I can't answer the question very authoritatively, but I can say that there are studies, people looking at this very issue, and it's an important one. I think I mentioned that, you know, the Reagan rhetoric has galvanized the states. You know, historically, we have seen time and again when the federal government steps back from education, the states take the initiative. There's never any real vacuum created in terms of initiative. And I think that by far and away, the most significant changes that are taking place in education are taking place at the state level, at the local level. And that is exactly what Reagan intended. I think that's exactly. Now, he may not, you know, we may end up saying, okay, this is what states and localities can do, but it's not enough. You know, there is a role for the federal government.
George Park.
You talk about the presidency in four-year terms, but go back to the civil rights problem and address it from the civil rights problem in education. Didn't we take a tremendous step back, and haven't we got to rethink the whole situation now?
You're saying, I guess I'm not quite following.
In the recent period,
whether we haven't taken a step back in using education as a tool for promoting civil rights?
No. When we faced the civil rights issue, which we did here locally, consolidate all the schools, which was the correct procedure, then that, in my opinion, dramatically affected the ability of the teachers and the everybody else in teaching. It also affected the presidency and what programs they could come up to that were acceptable.
Mm-hmm. You're right about that.
Now, my question is, are the presidents still dealing with that problem or not?
I would say not in a real direct way, and certainly this administration, if we look just at higher education, this administration has attempted to step back somewhat from using the federal government enforcement powers to make sure that higher education observes civil rights, law. So, I can't really answer the question. I don't know the answer to it. I think it's a good question. Maybe someone else has a thought.
May I broaden the question? I worked with Bennett when he was head of the National Endowment, and he generated a lot of enthusiasm there. What worried me about him was that I felt he never looked under the rock, but he brought a doctrine to the meetings and had real commitments to particular groups. For instance, of all things, he was very supportive of a group called the American Society for International Law. The committee I was on was International Relations. Well, they've grown rather fat and fancy with their projects, and if he had studied it carefully, I don't think he would have been quite as enthusiastic. What I wonder, and it's George Palmer's question in another form, is do we know what works in this? Maybe all of three of you.
Yeah,
what works for this heterogeneous group? We gave money, most of you have heard this, we gave money at the Rockefeller Foundation to a number of high schools in places like Watts to buy comic books and sporting magazines, because the argument of enlightened principals and superintendents was the students would read those things. And they weren't reading the kinds of things that were given in other schools. Mm-hmm. But I don't know whether that was a crutch that really didn't lead on to any next stage, or I don't know what any of the rest of you believe about that. But I didn't have the feeling in working with Bennett there that this kind of empirical investigation particularly interested him. And now with the Bennett-Alan Bloom new think tank, I don't imagine that they're going to sit around and ask, what do you Republicans think, what do you Democrats think. They're bringing a doctrine of sort, and maybe the right one, but it leaves me wondering whether we're really exploring these empirical data.
Well, Jennings Wagner is, I guess, on terms with Chester Finn, who is the head of the Office of Educational Research and Improvement, which is the main research and information sharing arm of the U.S. Department of Education. And can you speak to that at all?
Oh, you're dragging me into this. No. Questions of that magnitude I can't answer at all, except to observe, I think, Ken, in terms of the comic books and other approaches, that maybe one of the lessons there is that there is not a best system of one best way of doing it. For some kids, that might do it. Bill Bennett may be very right that for many others, we could do a great deal more with the classics and with the prescribed curriculum. To try to force all of our diverse population, though, through one funnel and say this is the only way to do it, I think may be our problem in a way. So I think the Rockefeller Foundation was probably wise to fund those projects and to follow up on them and see if they worked, and if so, with what groups, and look at other problems that might work as well or better with a different population.
Mr. George, I admit that my feelings are tainted by being a battle-scarred former school administrator and teacher. The thing that bothers me about this thing is that, for one thing, education is really a political football. Mm-hmm. You implied that thing every 4 years, and it happens locally, and it happens all the rest of the time. So I think parents are beginning to get a little disillusioned. The thing I worry about Bennett is, who else is talking about what the schools are like besides Bennett? Now, you know that people aren't researching, and they're not reading The Nation, and they're not reading all these other things. They're watching Bennett on 35 seconds, and then they're having the feeling, well, this must be so. Nobody's counteracting this. The thing that scares the hell out of me with Bennett is I've never once heard him say, we've got to teach kids to think. I know he wants them to have all this memorized data, and he wants all this other stuff, and he wants clones of him, but I've never once heard him say, our problem is we aren't teaching kids to think. And I go back to 180 years ago when I taught senior high school, and the seniors had an opinion, and I said, how do you back that up? And he said, I read it in the newspaper. And I said, well, did you read a couple other newspapers? And he said, no, what's the point? I already read it in this one. That's kind of scary for a high school senior, but it's even scarier when you get 30, 40, 60-year-old people who, frankly, are doing the same kind of thing. And I really think, you know, Bennett's fine to give his viewpoint, but it really scares me that there's not somebody else getting his. And again, one last thing, as a practical school administrator, this is all great, except every time these winds kind of shift, all this time you've been me working on getting this kid from climbing the walls and keeping this kid in school, mm-hmm. and getting this kid fed so he will come and not be abused, and then somebody's coming in with all these things, well, Bennett said, and you know, the schools are expected to do so much. Where did integration start? They didn't integrate neighborhoods.
Right.
They dumped it on the schools and then say, gee, the schools aren't doing this good a job. They expect the schools to solve the drug problem. The schools have a part in this. But the thing that scares me, and I don't think I'm out of this, don't have to worry about it anymore. But the thing is, these politicians, while they're doing some very good things about education, they're also creating some real practical problems.
All right. I think I have to respond to what you're saying. I think that you're right that the schools are a political football. The problem is in our society is that schools are the one things that we can exercise some control over, or so we think. We have denied ourselves the right to go into another man's home or woman's home and say, I'm sorry, but you need to raise your children the following way, and what you're doing now is wrong. We don't allow ourselves to do that. I've been working on with abused children in Alexandria with the court system. We do not, kids can have to be battered a million times, sexually abused, not fed. I mean, there's the evidence that you need to get a kid out of this home, to interfere with the rights of the parents and how the parents conduct themselves in the home is overwhelming.
So what are, if we won't allow ourselves to work with families, and we won't allow ourselves to, you know, violate a man's home as his castle principle, what's the next best thing? Well, get into the schools and use the schools as social welfare agencies, and that's essentially what we do.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, the problem is that we have to change our thinking. Either we continue to use them that way because that's the best way to get, that's where the kids are, and we get to them legally, or we change, you know, we go to more of the system where we pull kids out of their home environments early on and start institutionalizing them and giving them all the same type of experience.
You're exactly right, but how many people are really aware of the fact that we're doing exactly what you're saying, expecting the schools to be the socializing institutions for all this?
Yeah, we don't.
95% of the people would be surprised when you made that statement. Mm-hmm. Subliminally, it's round there somewhere, but mm-hmm. when you really say, this is it, it's going to come as a shock to an awful lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Young has a 12 o'clock meeting. Do you have any questions about the place of this within presidential studies or anything that was said in the first half that you may want to comment on?
No, I was a bit puzzled for a while there. I don't think I am anymore. Whether you thought the presidency should be more innovative or less, given the fact that it is something of a political football, mm-hmm. on which a lot of words are spent, but not a terrific amount of action. The history you cited of presidential interventions and the part that the presidency took in development of educational policy was a mixed record, it seems mm-hmm. to me, as you were citing. Would you like to see the presidency more innovative or more constrained?
Well, I haven't quite decided. I'm leaning in the direction of seeing the presidency use its visibility to force the nation to accept a common agenda of problems. Now, whether we all come up with the same solutions to the problem is another thing. But I would like to see the presidency, maybe use, again, another national commission, some way to sit down and hammer out what the key issues are that we need to be addressing. You know, are we merely talking about getting kids to raise their, you know, SRA scores by one standard deviation, or are we talking about, you know, getting kids to function well in society, to be literate, to be, you know, good world citizens, and that sort of thing? I guess my aggravation is with the very piecemeal approach that we see even in the candidates' discussion. It's a little dressing here and a little dressing there, but no one is willing to take a bite and say, now, I don't have the answers, but I do know what the questions are, and I would like to see the federal government take a bigger role and see the presidency in particular take a bigger role in saying, these are what the questions are.
Is that realistic, Professor Young?
Do you expect it?
No, based on our history, no. Unless, you know, we need a major crisis. Yes.
Victor Yumke, you had a question.
Yes, in the mid-1960s, I attended a seminar at Columbia University on adult education.
Mm-hmm.
And the finding there, the conclusions were drawn, for at least the non-professional workforce, that people have to change their occupation at least 3 times over their lifespan. And they're trying to set up programs which would encompass the business community and the educational community and the person themselves. Has there been anywhere in the country that has been worked out successfully on a kind of a partnership basis?
Gosh.
I'm thinking of people 30, 40 years of age that are right now in trouble.
Well, I know that in Massachusetts, Governor Dukakis keeps saying that he's done something along those lines in Massachusetts through his, Centers of Excellence. He is one of the programs he is proposing that I didn't mention is a federal program to create centers of excellence around the country in which you have the cooperation of higher education, businesses, nonprofit sector in revitalizing
those areas of the country. And I think he means mainly economically, but it would address the problem that you're talking about. You know, how do you enable people to make the changes that they have to make? You know, adult education and preparing for changes in careers and stuff. I am not an expert in that area, and I would love to be able to tell you that there are things going on in specific places. I don't know what those are. I suspect they exist.
Ken, Mitch followed up since I've been involved, but the community college in this state was set up to do just that.
Mm-hmm.
Part of their charge was to retrain people.
I think that has been changed now.
Mm-hmm.
It's been taken out of the community college department. They were, the partnership was with the community college system, and I think it's been changed. It's now in the Department of Economic Development.
I wondered what your evaluation was of Ben, the Secretary of Education. You've made some comments throughout.
Well, you put me on the spot. I like him personally. I like his personality. I believe in the gadfly approach to getting people off their duffs. But that is my temperament as well. So, I mean, I see in him a kindred spirit in some respects. On the other hand, I think that it's some of what we have done in education. I think the cutbacks that were initially enacted as part of an overall fiscal discipline were acceptable if all programs and domestic programs and defense are going to be subjected to it. I'm not sure I like the idea of singling out, you know, education for discipline when there are high rollers over in the Defense Department, or I should say consulting agencies and things like that. I think he has been good because he has forced us to get mad and talk about things. I don't know much about his record as an administrator or anything like that. He certainly has been distinctive and has brought some visibility to education, and I see all those things as good in the long run. And in terms of the actual policies that he has endorsed, I think the jury is still out.
Jen, is it safe to say he gave education a common enemy? Any other questions from the educational elite?
My relief
pictures. Well, when Harold Laswell finished his PhD, where the committee said after he left the room, how do we keep him from coming back and making a worse fool of us the next time? And that's what we said when Janet finished her PhD exam. Hoped he should never come back for a post-PhD. And she's shown us why that was today. We're very grateful to you for coming.
My pleasure.